what we established was that the benchmark approach needs only the existence of the numerator portfolio, and we are in. By this, by definition already, we deal with semi-martingales because we have the super-martingale property. So benchmark non-negative portfolios are super-martingales, although they need to be non-negative. And once we have this, then we can start. We are in principle that in a situation which is similar to the risk-neutral one, where you discounted but you shifted yourself into a risk-neutral world under, say, putative risk-neutral measure. And I indicated that when we look at data and try to find out what may be the radionicotine derivative of the putative risk-neutral measure that would fit our real world, then there is a bit of problem. It looks more that we have to deal with a strict super-martingale for that object, this benchmark savings account, at least if you want to handle it with a complete market. And having this seen, then we went further. I gave examples. And to make now the benchmark approach practical, really practical, so that you can touch it, that you can do pretty much everything, I came and talked about the diversification theorem. And this idea is very simple. And at the end, you see it's the most basic theorem or fact or law we have in statistics. We have also when we deal with probabilistic objects, the law of large numbers is behind that. And this diversification theorem is, in principle, model independent. I don't need any real model, only very, very little structure. It has similarities to the law of large numbers, and if you want, a little bit with the central limit theorem, but I would say the law of large numbers is it. And you can see it. And I just, hand-waving, I explain in principle what, in a very stylized form, a one-line proof in principle of that diversification theorem is. Think we are already now in benchmarked securities, so we have our benchmark securities. Or benchmark primary security accounts, which where we can invest in. So what are they expressing? They show that this general market risk, which is more or less in this numerator portfolio, in this market index, this is taken away by just benchmarking. So what we see, each benchmark primary security account is just showing us, in principle, the specific market risk or the idiosyncratic market risk or idiosyncratic risk. So if you make it extreme and say we have a fantastic market segmentation and securities constructed such that each benchmark security is just having independent returns from the other benchmark securities because they have just a specific risk or uncertainty with respect to these primary security account. So if you have then independent returns for each time step and form a portfolio which is just a weighted average of the returns that you have, these independent ones, make it equal value weighted, so just summing and dividing by the number. So what it is, by the law of large numbers, you will find for these total return of the resulting benchmark portfolio, you will find that by the law of large numbers, this zero mean independent return, with of course finite variances, will sum up by this weighting to asymptotic to something which is just zero return, law of large numbers. So what when you have achieved this, what is it? Then you have a benchmark portfolio which has zero returns. So it is a constant. And a benchmark portfolio that is just a constant, it is more or less a numerator portfolio. That's it. So by the law of large numbers, the law of nature, the nature of the markets, whatever you want here, agents acting or not, it doesn't matter. Once there's a numerate portfolio, just by this large size, and of course the economic structure that securities are reasonably independent, because this is why we securitize, then you find that the aggregate of all of that, that is very diversified, will converge more or less in the benchmark world to a constant and also a proxy of the numerate portfolio. And then there may be many different ways, although Mateus may have a completely other weighting on some of the securities than I have or you have and whatever company comes up. But as soon as they are really diversified, a global player like, I think of Deutsche Bank or some other investment banks or insurance companies, so I'm working with Munich Re, their portfolios that are very, very diversified. And if they do mistakes, concentrate very much on their own market only, then, okay, they have a lot of specific risk still there. But I'm thinking very much like reinsurers, they diversify as much as they can and are very careful how much risk from this region and that region and this kind of catastrophic events and so on they get on, and they're distributed also a lot. Yes. Oh, okay, good. This is where, thank you. This is a very, very nice comment. Very important. Yes. So if they were all, if all benchmark securities would be martingales, I think then the argument is clear. So what we have, and we come to this, in a jump diffusion market, so E2 process driven or jump diffusion driven, all the, but we saw it already in some form, the benchmark securities are all local martingales. So locally we have more or less the martingale property. And of course, with very frequent rehedging, you get in principle then still these kind of effect. What we are doing when forming then this proxy of the numerator portfolio, we're actually hedging. So fund management becomes hedging, real hedging. And this, although what you're just saying, this had been in my mind for quite some time. Of course, I showed you already, and I will show you in a minute again, simulations where we have the model and then we simulate and see what is coming up. And I was very much concerned about what you say. Yes, we have some models where, for instance, benchmark savings account or other benchmark securities are strict super martingales. Does it still work? And I was a bit worried about that. Yeah. But I submitted to Vachelier a paper where I first have a diversification theorem will be mentioned, and then I did the following on that paper. We went for a wide range of models, so where the asset prices follow many different dynamics, where I have exact or almost exact simulation methods. That's another issue where there's another theme in that paper, so exact simulation. But then I simulate large markets with a couple of hundreds or maybe even thousand securities, and they are exact or almost exact simulated. That means I can go over 150, 300 years, and these paths are pretty much exact. There's nothing but, say, an Euler scheme or so, all these errors that come from that, even that I wrote these books. There are, of course, over a long time, a lot of propagation of errors. You have stability problems. I don't have them. So I simulate this and just simply check whether this diversification theorem kicks in. And it kicks always in. And the beauty is, the real beauty is, and this will be a nice slide in my talk at Bachelier and plus other things around the diversification. The beauty is, when I model, say, the primary security accounts, say, by the Stylus minimum market model, also what I showed you already a little bit, where we have really a strict super martingale, the difference over longer periods of time between what, say, the market portfolio, also just hold one stock from each and don't hedge, no, just buy and hold, compared to this hedging where I make equal value weighting, the difference is enormous. So the equal value weighted index is way, way, way off so much better than the market capitalization weighted index. Where these models, say Black-Scholes model and Heston model and others, where I know that I have martingales when benchmarked, the equivalue weighted index is very nice, very much better, but these are not magnitudes. So as your question, as I was worried, at the end I was positively surprised that it all works. And then afterwards you can think. You can say, yes, that's understandable. Locally, they behave like martingales. Okay. So locally, they do the hedge in the way as you want, and so that they get the returns pretty much. The benchmark returns aggregate more or less to the zero, and you have then pretty much this kind of constant return for the benchmark resulting approximate portfolio. In the long term, the buy and hold gives me the strict super martingales. So I just have the sum of strict super martingales. Yeah? And that's, the question was absolutely correct, but it works really very much in favor of saying that you should do fund management not just by simply buy and hold, what most industry is doing. No, you should hedge. And you should hedge such that the key factors, that means the key driving sources of uncertainty, are kept in a balance. That means with almost equal value, because also, or constant proportions if you want. Why? If it happens that, say, some industry, which is mainly factors are very much around industries, if one industry gets really a boost and the prices go up for a while, okay, then it's time, in principle, to sell, also to bring it the value down. Why? The capital goes then into other places where it will have to come up somehow, because these factors, I wouldn't say they are mean reverting, but there is this kind of balance. And there was a talk yesterday about demand and supply. Yes, there is some kind of an equilibrium. And the thing is, so what counts here are the market prices of risk. And one thing, I have not really worked out in detail in any of these papers that I have so far published, but the idea is, in principle, there's capital. What are you doing with it? To try to make more capital out of it. So what is the measure? What does it for you? It's the market price of risk. Okay, so you have many opportunities. All the investors have these opportunities. So there is some kind of a balance over the market price of risk, whatever you can get in this industry, and whatever kind of projects. So this is just what is going on all the time. So there's a balance in this. So this is also why you need a balance in the investment in these factors, because then you get more or less always the kind of maximum growth at the end. So diversification is model independent. It's the easiest thing, the most ancient. It goes 4,000 or more years back that we have documents that say in principle that you should just spread your risk and you have a very important effect. Yes. Then you... So you deal, yeah. Yep. Yes, but we come to that, because if you go to the limit and think of continuous hedging, trading, then we are there in any case. The stochastic calculus tells us this already. The question is just what errors we have to deal with. And the good thing is that our local martingales, or local martingales, or non-negative local martingales, which are just strict local martingales, still, as I showed on this graph, and I showed you the mass of the risk-neutral measure, they go very flat out of zero. This is the nature of that thing. So the Stylus Minimal Market Model showed you that the expected value, it was very flat, and all derivatives are zero here. All derivatives are zero. It was so flat, it was so 4 or 5 years or so, and then it comes finally down. And we are, of course, here in one day, and not, and so. So in principle, the asymptotics is also from a practical point of view fantastic. And what you do, you just hedge. As you hedge other things. And of course I can hedge the minimum market model, as I showed, and why I shouldn't hedge now everything to achieve the simple thing in the benchmark world, a zero return. This is just. And this is model independent. The law of large numbers gives me that. So very, very robust. It couldn't be more robust, and it couldn't also not be more fundamental. It's just the first and most basic law that keeps our probabilistic modeling world and understanding together. We have it here in the market. So, and here, also this I showed you. I showed you also this. It doesn't. Sorry, it was too fast now. I've showed you already this, but I repeat it. This is data stream data where 104 world industry sector accumulation indices are provided. So different industries, and one is tobacco, other is alcohol, or beverages also. So this is just something we have. And these are now our constituents. And in this, I formed simply an equivaluated index out of it. And this was what I showed you. The market capitalization one gives you this here, which is also the data stream MSCI in principle. It has also Morgan Stanley capitalization index. They look all around this. And but you can get already out of this investment universe more. And I will probably at the Bachelier conference and present results, if I'm allowed to do that, where there will be a portfolio which is even far beyond that, for some reasons, and I will explain them. Yeah? So that is very, very interesting. But it's pretty much hedging in fund management. Hedging, active hedging, but not stock picking. And that's because the market is doing the job already. They pick all the time. They chase the market, either the market price of risk wherever they can find it, or predict it, or expect it. What we have to do in this 60,000 stock investment universe is just to diversify out anything which is diversifiable, and the remaining thing is in the benchmark benchmark world and all this, this return zero thing, which is giving us a constant in the benchmark setting. And we don't need to know the numerator portfolio for that, we just do it, and then it comes out. That's it. This is the basics, the practical basic of the benchmark approach. I can take this thing then, or a good proxy of it, here is one, and or better ones, and then it starts. All questions we know and have used and answered in part are maybe under risk neutral paradigm and others. They can be reformulated, and in many ways they get just simpler, the answers, and more robust. For instance, the assumption on the existence of an equivalent risk neutral measure, you can just forget it. You don't need it. So here a little bit other things. I took the minimum market model, stylized, generated primary security accounts according to the minimum market model. Here's what's about 20. And what you see compared to the earlier ones, which I showed you, which were Black-Scholes type models, so much braver things. Here you get enormous outbursts. So it's like a Yahoo stock and things like that. Other things we see also in reality. These kind of feedback effects are just right. And then I can go, and these are the benchmarked primary security accounts. Now these are the super martingales, the local martingales, the strict local martingales. Yes, and you see, okay, there are still outbursts. And at the end, in principle, there is a long run downward trend, even that they behave in this region. You could not distinguish them from martingales. There is no way of doing that. But in the long term, you see that this. And here is the numerator portfolio, or the GOP, the growth optimal portfolio. This is the red one, or the pink one, and the equivaluated index in this universe which I have generated. Okay, and you see that they behave pretty nicely, similar. And if I would go from what was 50 stocks to 1,000 stocks, then you wouldn't see any difference anymore here. It's just the law of large numbers. But this is the equivaluated index. And now you may wonder, okay, I showed you for the Black-Scholes model just the market capitalization weighted index. Here we get now some, you remember here, I just go back, we got now some benchmark stocks which are really large, yeah, So they have big marginalization when you take them just one of each in. So that means the market capitalization weighted index may be different. And you saw that around here there was this kind of big outburst of some stocks. And you see also here that the theoretical numerator portfolio, the gross optimal portfolio, is not following this kind of, let me call it, bubble or outburst in one of or some of the stocks. But then it had suffered, this other this market index, because it was no longer really optimal. And because it lost the diversification, it went and with. It could be, in some situation, and you see it here for a while, there may be a better performance on this, say here, market index. But in the long term, no. Because it is not the numerator portfolio. It's not this one which has these best performance properties which I showed you, which just come from the super Martingale property. So this is the situation. And if I show you real data, say when I do it with regional indices, where we had where we had the Japanese stock bubble for some time, also based on regional indices, I had a similar. You have a very similar effect. That there was an overshooting at the beginning. The market capitalization weighted index that invested a lot in the Japanese bubble was really ahead for a moment, but then of course it burst the Japanese bubble, and within this procedure, within this part, it couldn't recover. It's very similar to that. Yes, it's less diversified. Why? As here in the simulated, you can see it easily. Let me go back. Here, you have, this is where the typical stocks are, or the benchmark stocks are, and here is now a few really big ones, in particular that. So that is many times than the typical. And look at the Yahoo and at the others, we had these situations in our real market too. And it may go on for a couple of years or even a decade for some of these stocks, but it's typically always some time over. Okay, so we talked about now the basics on the benchmark approach. We know where we get the numerator portfolio also in practice from, and after my talk at Bachelier, there will be something on my website, and probably you can download data and experiment with it, and you will see. Also later I come to that, it has fantastic statistical properties because it will be the best, or is the best diversified portfolio, a very well diversified portfolio. One thing which the benchmark approach tries is it tries to put an umbrella and to bring all the major risk management tasks we have together. So one is portfolio optimization. Other will be pricing and hedging, also of long dated securities. Another is financial planning. And which I will not touch at all in this talk here is macroeconomic modeling. So I do work with Willy Semler, where we talk about interest rate and inflation rate modeling, monetary policies and things like that. It all comes together. So, but let's go for portfolio optimization. So we already discussed that numerator portfolio is the best long-term investment. And we have two fund separation, which you can show here. I indicated later a little bit. I cannot go over all of these here, but you find sections and chapters, sections in the book which I mentioned. Also, Markowitz mean variance efficient portfolio optimization. In the book, I have a whole section on that. It comes just out in a very nice way. Also, the intertemporal capital asset pricing model you can just retrieve. However, you have to be a bit careful. The role of the market portfolio that you find in the classical economic theory is in principle, or has to be in principle, to be substituted by pretty much the numerator portfolio. And the market portfolio is not the numerator portfolio. That's just a fact. Just a fact. And so I'm not going here in more details. Absolutely, sure. Now, also look, there is this argument and the kind of investigation from a French and so on. Can you prove the capital asset pricing model? Can you show it empirically and so on? There's no need for it. I show you the equations, or we have them already. I can show you this. It's just a fact. This cap M relations are true locally. However, the market price of risk is a process. It's fluctuating all the time. It's this 1 over square root of y, which I showed you in my in the minimum market model type thing. So it's useless and just a wrong question to think you are able to estimate this or to prove this and some other to empirically to prove it. It's just nonsense. No, it's a wrong question. You cannot estimate any drift component in this world, so you can't answer it. It's a waste of energy. However, mathematically, you just write it down what you say. You just see it yourself. I could go back to the slide, but it comes later probably again, and then I show you, I point my finger on it. It's just there. It's now for a mathematician immediately to see. But you find it here in this section in that book. And there is another book which I haven't really mentioned here, but those who want to have a compact and also later presentation of the benchmark approach than I gave in the 2006 book with David Heath. I submitted just before I came here to Springer Verlag a book with Bodhi Liberati on numerical solution of stochastic differential equation with jumps in finance. It's a follow-up book that I wrote with Peter Klöden many years ago, which some of you may know. And so it's now on jumps, and it's on finance, and chapter 3 is about 50 pages, just benchmark approach. So very much the kind of things we discuss here, and so there you find that. If you look for a compact summary of things, this is this chapter 3 in that new book, which in a couple of months should be in the market. So, but I'm not going into it here, because I like to cover other things. One thing which is very interesting and comes from economic theory and people want to see is utility maximization. We can do that, and we will see nice things. But I'm saying this is not the core where we come from. We don't need anything else than just prices, a numerator portfolio, and the super martingale structure which automatically comes with it, and then we get most of it. The rest is then when you try and need to get some expectations calculated, also then you have to start to build a model and get your distributions right and can then hedge and do other things. But demand supply, as yesterday came a question there, this is not our primary objective. Of course, if you use it and get maybe your market order book and your dynamic microstructure and whatever model by this, fine, do this. But what will happen? You will have a result. The result is a benchmark security as it evolves. And there's a numerator portfolio, which is pretty much the numerator portfolio in units of that savings account where you are when you invert it. Also, you have always, you just all the time you work just with a numerator portfolio. Yeah? So let me just look at this comment here. Think of the benchmark savings account, which was the savings account in units of the numerator portfolio. Okay, if you model this as say strict super martingale, local martingale, okay. And the savings account, which is of course always a nice object, where you have maybe your short rate here, okay. If you have modeled this, you know this, that means you have modeled also this, then you get out of it immediately that your numerator portfolio, yeah, in units of domestic currency, even if you want that, it is in principle then the savings account divided by the benchmark savings account. So these both things you have modeled, okay? And if you like to go further in your domestic world, after you have modeled all the benchmark securities, say, then you can get your, say, first other primary security account, maybe your first stock, by doing what? You have your benchmarked first stock. This is modeled like a local martingale, a strict local martingale, depends on what your model is telling you, and times the benchmark. And then you are there. So in principle, you have just to concentrate on modeling benchmarked objects. And in principle, out of this comes everything. Yeah. And the important thing is this numerical portfolio when expressed in units of, say, a primary security account like a currency or maybe a commodity or also stock, they are, what they are. This is in a very, very well diversified index in units of what you're looking at, say, in your currency. And the nice thing is the volatility, if I do it, for instance, in US dollars, the volatility of such a diversified portfolio, as I just showed you, is about 9%, 8%. Yeah? S&P 500 reaches 14, 15. Market capitalization weighted index becomes clearly higher. Yeah? And so there's a lot to gain when you do it in this way. So, but coming back then to expected utility maximization, still we like to understand what this kind of ranking, what we can do with utility expressing preferences, which no one really knows what you have, but it is a good mathematical tool, but very deliberate. I'm not following what economic thinking, economic theory, parts of finance has been doing over several decades. I'm not saying utility is the center of it. We have already basic structures which come up without utility. As I said, the cap-end relationship, I don't need equilibrium. I don't need anything. I need only the super martingale property, and then it falls into place. So utility functions, let's take some. See, example, power utility or look utility, and let's just do something with it. So here, of course, the typical graphs. And maximize expected utility. But be careful. I'm doing something slightly different as typically one is doing. I have the utility function. I take a portfolio in units of, or in some reference unit. So I put a bar on, which means in units of the savings account. Yeah? So the, just to give us my reference unit, but I could take any other reference unit, but I take this. So then I take the real world expectation, conditioned, although I could even leave it out, although at the beginning, the information at the beginning, and maximize. So the maximization goes over all these admissible strategies which I might have, also say strictly positive portfolios. But I'm looking not only at portfolios which have the budget constraint that it starts at initial capital, with initial capital at zero. I know already from this law of the minimal price, when I like to achieve something in my investment universe, I should not take some portfolios, I should just concentrate on fair portfolios. These are then the cheapest ways to achieve something. And a utility maximization is just such a goal. So I will maximize over strictly positive discounted fair portfolios. That's very important. And this is a very, very important insight that you just need to do that and not take the whole investment universe. So, and then we can take, in principle, the martingale approach to stochastic control or expected utility maximization. And what comes out is then, if you make sure that, say, your benchmark savings account is just a scalar diffusion, like in a minimum market model, then I can formulate it easily. Otherwise, it becomes more complicated, but in principle, all the same is coming out. This optimal portfolio that maximizes the expected utility, but optimal portfolio benchmark, so the benchmarked optimal portfolio will come out as real-world expectation of inverse of the first derivative of the utility of Lagrange multiplier, which comes from budget constraints, times benchmark savings account, times benchmark reference unit, what I have. And here again, benchmark savings account. So this is just a law of nature which comes out here. And of course, this is known in some forms when you look at the literature, martingale approach gives you something like that. So this is the optimal portfolio, fair portfolio. And yes, you can then also, of course, describe it in many ways. For instance, this tells you here in this scalar diffusion case, which I have used here for just explaining it, what you get is a two-fund separation. Your optimal portfolio for any such utility will be such that you invest in this reference unit, here our savings account, a fraction at some time, and the remainder in the numerator portfolio. And between these, you allocate and reallocate, and how much this fraction, which in this case is often has often to do with a risk aversion coefficient, or the inverse of it, would be called the fraction of an investment. And you can, of course, in this case, which I have chosen here, where everything is Markov and nice, you can write it all down. But in any case, what we find is two-fund separation and a nice simple description, recovering some of the results we have, but this is pretty general. Look utility, of course, gives you then the numerator portfolio back, so there will be this optimal portfolio will be just a constant, depending on the budget constraints. And if you would do it with power utility, you can calculate it through your optimal portfolio. This conditional expectation would be then some constant, and here again, some kind of a power structure, depending on whatever model you had. And if you have Black-Scholes model, then, okay, these are calculations which you know from other similar places. But it comes very nicely out. And the Lagrange multiplier here, for instance, in the Black-Scholes situation, of course, you just calculate it through. Why I did the utility, I wanted to come also to utility indifference pricing, which I'm doing now. But back to utility, yeah? Yep. So, in the case where in your model, your dynamics allows an equivalent risk neutral probability measure, I would say we get the same. So the Black-Scholes situation is the same. For the minimum market model, I haven't checked this question. It's interesting. We should maybe see what happens. I think it's more similar as what you show with the zero coupon bond thing. There will be a similar effect. Supermarketing gains that I don't do the best thing, because the risk neutral pricing rule would just choose this higher in principle priced portfolio, which risk neutral formally would do. Yeah, but so there are differences. Yes, and there are different. This is the question is important. Yet if you do utility maximization and do it with a now common and classical way where often risk neutral comes at certain place in, you maybe not at the really optimal portfolio. If you try to come close to reality, you have similar effects as I had already shown with the zero coupon bonds. So here's another important thing. If you like to go financial planning or other things with utility maximization and have to come up with strict local martingales in this long-term modeling what you are doing, yes, you may have then a bias. And this can be considerable if you go for long periods of time. And this has to do a lot with macroeconomic and other things. And yes, in this paper with Willy Semler, which we do on the monetary policy, and where we have get an interest rate rule and an inflation rate rule out, I deliberately, of course, go under the benchmark approach and don't do anything in this neutral. I do it here with fair securities. Good, but now let's go to utility indifference pricing, because this is a concept which has been around for many, many years, and Mark Davison picked it up, and it's also now in our community quite common to think this way. What question is, what kind of pricing rule will now come up when we do that? So let's do utility indifference pricing. So we have a payoff that cannot be perfectly hedged. And the idea is, in principle, you have a utility. If there's now extra contingent claim coming in, you know what you do with your capital. You have an optimal strategy, and you just decide to follow this strategy for the bulk of your capital. But then maybe a small contingent claim comes up, and you like to value it. Consistent with what your investment strategy under this year expected to 3D maximization is doing. So what you are doing is you take a small amount away, epsilon, away from your initial capital and multiply it with your candidate price, which you still have to find, which is an S0 measurable, and then invest still in your optimal portfolio. Okay. Plus, now you have this small epsilon, this fraction of this payoff, which is non-hedgeable. So, but you take the utility of all of that, and let's denote it as V. Epsilon is showing us here this, and we want to find the price V. I can do it, of course, also with epsilon to zeros, and I have my old utility maximization as I had. And we say a utility indifference price is given by this relation. If you look at the first derivative of this here with respect to epsilon, then it should just the indifference should just be zero. That means this is what we have here. This is if epsilon is zero divided by epsilon and C. If there's no change, if I come out of a very small epsilon, then we call this V Z, which is coming up there in the limit, we call it the utility indifference price. So just simple things. Yes, come in. No. So here, makes it really, this is why this derivation which I show you is very simple and easy. I'm not totally maximizing now everything here through. I'm just saying we know what our utility maximizing strategy is if I have not this claim coming up. So I take it and I run. Then I take a small fraction of it to satisfy the purchase of this contingent claim. And I like to know what is the correct price for this. But I leave the other running because this is money that runs in some fund which is just creating my expected utility maximizing wealth process. So, and then I still take the utility from this, which I know, and have here this, and still it's a question, what is coming out when I do that? Yeah? And it's very natural. You can explain it easily to any manager and so on. You have not to involve a very complicated, tedious, in principle, almost impossible, although very difficult, tractable, of course, if you have your many different claims, optimization problem for all of that, as you said. But it's very important fine-tuned question. But since we go to the asymptotics, that will be fine. So we go with this to the asymptotics. And then there's something very interesting happening, which you see. What you are doing is look now at this expected utility where we have this price in and expand it just by Taylor expansion. Very easy because epsilon is small, so you can do that. Under the expectation, so it will be using utility just for the optimal portfolio, plus epsilon times the first derivative of it, and of course then multiplied, which was there in front of it, plus higher order terms, which we forget, and I put just here the approximation on it. Okay? But this means the first thing is just my expected utility if there was zero investment in this extra claim. So I get epsilon of expectation of the U prime thing times the H bar. The V goes out. Epsilon is there. Expectation of the U prime thing times what is still sending here. Okay? So very easy calculation. But you see now, something very interesting happened. You remember, our optimal portfolio was the inverse of the first derivative of the utility function. That's a deep connection. The inverse, and this means here inside, this is it here. Here inside, there inside sits this expression. So, first derivative, on inverse first derivative, it will give us, of course, an offsetting of the utility function itself. It's not relevant at all anymore. by formulating this method, this question this way. So this means when I go through it, there will be then here an offsetting. I will find inside just the lambda S hat 0 times the H bar minus the V and, here's the same situation of what I had. The lambda S hat 0 and this in front of this there. So I get this difference. Okay, I can take this first derivative, and you see what is happening as first the choice, your choice of utility is vanished. It's just offsetting itself. And the price, when I just solve the last equation for the utility indifference price, then I get these expectations here. And if I look carefully, I can cancel a number of things. I find then this expression. Here is this numerator portfolio. Here is at the beginning. So, but if you just look at it, it's nothing but the real world pricing formula again. So for non-hedgeable claim. Yes? In principle, yes. In principle, yes. Yes. Yeah, of course, it is a question, and the mathematician has many ways of formulating this question, but typically it depends very much on how you ask the question. Clear. And what I'm suggesting is here, make it not more difficult than really necessary for what we want. I still have an optimization to perform. It's not so that there's nothing to calculate. It's just so that I say, this wealth that, say, maybe a company has, yeah, and then there is this claim coming up, this small claim, it's, even if you would optimize it, probably you would end up very much there. But this is a question still. There may be cases that it doesn't work. But here, so if you formulate it this way, we see immediately the utility doesn't matter. So we come up with real-world pricing. But in any case, I'm saying this is not the way how I like, in principle, the derivation of prices also, because it's too subjective. And also, you might say, oh, it's subjective as you chose here your utility maximization altogether. Fine. But there are other results which come later. Still, I wanted to create a link that you see that this is linked to utility maximization and it's not in an uninteresting way. Let's go for hedging, because what we know from the real-world pricing formula, even if it is not a non-hedgeable claim, the benchmarked price at some earlier time t is the expectation of the benchmarked payoff. So, assume the following. Assume that your benchmark primary security accounts are square integrable local martingales. Assume also for the moment that this is the square integrable and a little bit more, but then you get in this world the Galchuk Kunita Watanabe decomposition, or Fermat Schweitzer decomposition if you go into the this neutral world and things this way. So you get a martingale representation which is such that here you have this expectation plus the sum here, if you have a continuous market, what I'm at the moment in, over all these driving Wiener processes which express traded uncertainty with some integrants predictable plus some remainder which is a martingale, and this is orthogonal to all what we have here. And in this way, under the real-world probability, in a benchmark setting, without assuming the existence of a minimal martingale measure or risk-neutral measure of any kind, we have then expression or, yes, a representation which gives us an absolutely clear guide what to do in hedging. You could just take now a quadratic criterion like Fermat-Sondermann or more advanced than Fermat-Schweitzer or local risk minimization, And it is then very clear what you need to do. You patch, in principle, with these strategies, which you have to find out, and you leave, in principle, this untouched. What you are doing by real-world pricing is you project this benchmark claim into the prices at time t in such a way that the remainder at the time when you start to price starts with zero and is a martingale and is orthogonal. That means the variance of this, if you want, hedge error or profit and loss, benchmark profit and loss, this variance is minimized. So what you are doing is an in principle mean variance hedging in some way, but it's identical to logarithm minimization in the case when you have all the assumptions needed, and I'm just writing with Biagini and Cretarola all these things down for what you call benchmark logarithm minimization or benchmark mean variance hedging. But it's obvious what to do here. It's, the theorems which we have already from Fermat, from Schweitzer, they apply fully just in another way and without the assumption on the existence of an equivalent risk-neutral probability measure. So hedging is not a problem. Yeah. Whether you get your prices no via utility indifference pricing, which I just indicated, or you start just doing it via, say, I take real-world pricing not only for the hedgeable claims, which I explained with the law of the minimal price. If you go further and say, I do it for non-hedgeable claims, true, then what happens? There will be, under sufficient assumption, such a martingale representation, real-world martingale representation, and you see immediately, naturally, what one should do. Of course, you could try other things, but what you would do when you take not this kind of logarithm minimizing strategy, which here in benchmark setting comes up, then you would perturb this term here, and you would just create extra variance, extra error. There's no need for that. That will just cost. Yeah? So leave this untouched, but in the benchmark world. So hedging is also very clear and with fewer assumptions than you needed on the classical existing theory. And it applies to everything, also wherever you go. And the Kunita Watanabe decomposition is there in a very, very little that you have to assume. Even you don't not even need to assume that the driving asset prices are square integrable, only what you need to have, that these integrals will be square integrable, and then you get already all these kind of things. So Ansel Stricker has a nice paper which gives us the examples. So that means derivative prices in domestic currency, this is a real world pricing formula for domestic currency, the fractions come from this part, of course, in the decomposition here, which is here, and you need just to get your portfolios, your hedge portfolios in and compare. Here are the volatilities of the hedge portfolio. This was the volatility matrix in our continuous market. So you get the fractions out of this kind of multiplication, inverse of the volatility matrix of the primary security accounts. And this is here more or less, these are the volatilities of our hedging portfolio, and this have to be adjusted such that finally they give us in the right way our x from the decomposition, this predictable integrand. And since I'm doing it here, these are volatilities under domestic currency. I get here also the market price of risk in this form. So in any case, this is just comparison of diffusion coefficients. It gives you then the right rule. So hedging is clear in principle. It's natural. If you like to go to something else, you have profit and losses, benchmark profit and losses with larger variances. Or even if you do something else, you create even biases. And if you think you can hedge cheaper, this will be not working. Why? You do already here for the hedgeable part, which is pretty much this here, or this all together, So law of the minimum price tells us, since you have a fair portfolio for this part, this is the minimal hedge, whatever you can do. There's no way. It's already clear. And what you then concentrate on by doing this, what I call local risk minimization in principle, and this kind of strategy, what you see, you minimize the benchmark profit and loss in such a way that it is a martingale and orthogonal, so minimal variance. And that's it. Good. Let's now go further and see what we can do in connection to specific models. So we have the framework, we know about hedging already, we have talked about portfolio optimization, and let's now go and what we need when we like to calculate something, for instance, as we had payoff structures, you need to calculate the expectations, so finally you need to come up with some real-world dynamics, some modeling for the real-world dynamics, say, of benchmark securities or what drives them. So, and what we are doing, to keep it simple and focus, we concentrate on modeling well-diversified portfolios, so more or less the numerator portfolio in some denomination, which is equivalent, but looking at the inverse of this. Okay, this will be then the discounted index. So in this way, this is just what we have to work on. If you have a continuous market, always the structure for the numerator portfolio in whatever denomination will look like this. And okay, if you denominate it in the savings account, then it will be here a bar and the R would be gone. So okay, we now of course in this continuous market where I'm at the moment, the log gives me then this growth rate, but in any case the volatility is here, and we could even see it if you look at the quadratic variation and its derivative and then taking the square root of it. So we can see these kind of things. So here is such a plot when we just follow this last simple way of estimating volatility. But I must say, and we know it all, volatility is a very, very delicate object, in principle almost impossible at the moment to observe. You need quite some series of data to say anything always. So we need to understand really what is it driving and where it's in principle that reflected and what is what we need to model. Yeah, one thing which comes up later more, we know very well the Black-Scholes model is very poor, so take the histogram of S&P 500 hourly, the seasonalized log returns, then we know, of course, the log return distribution is not the Gaussian distribution. It's much fatter tailed and also more peaked, and it would be very good to understand what this distribution is, and I show you later what it is. It's pretty close to a student T4 distribution, and it has a reason, and we will see that reason. So we might look at implied volatilities. This is a very crucial topic. Even that I said yesterday, I don't like to model volatility. I'm forced to communicate with you and others this way because this is what is our parameter process which people typically use and how we specify models and so on. But you will see that I'm not thinking that it is the right way. Still, we do it. So European call, Black-Scholes model, take it. It's just a Black-Scholes formula in some way. Here's the volatility. And for given strike, K underlying S volatility sigma, we may find in the market observed prices or prices from a model, which are not Black-Scholes prices, and we can calculate the implied volatility, which is what comes up here when we solve Black-Scholes prices being equal to whatever market or model prices we have. So implied volatilities. We know the implied volatility surfaces are not constant, so Black-Scholes is not right. Over time, these implied volatility curves change, and of course it's a challenge to get an understanding of these and see them. If you go and take data, and here this is very similar, more or less I took the parameters for plotting it from a paper by Ramakant and De Fonseca, where they showed average S&P 500 implied volatility surfaces. What we see is here is the moneyness, here is time to maturity. What you see is you have a negative skew on this index options what we have, and a bit of term structure here, and later it becomes reasonably flat, but on the earlier time it's more curved, or the short time to mature is more curved. And we like to understand where this is coming from and like to have the flexibility of doing it. So it leads us one step away from Black-Scholes modeling. So one step away from Black-Scholes modeling is pretty much make volatility not a constant, make volatility a function of state variables. And the easiest is to make it a power function. And this gives you the constant elasticity of variance model. So we have a long list of papers that worked in this direction. And here are in classical risk neutral setting, the CEV versions discussed. Already in Delbarn and Shiragawa, there's a complaint in that paper which says, look, CEV risk neutral, there are problems. And they discuss it in some way. But what we did then with David Hees, we just looked at the CEV model in some form. We start from savings account, have a drifted Wiener process, and say, okay, let's take the CEV model and let's simply apply it blindly, as a lot of risk neutral literature is doing, blindly for our index modeling, that means for the numerical portfolio modeling. Let's take a CEV model. So here it would be. This is the gross optimal portfolio. You see here the short rate. This is a putative risk neutral Wiener process, just writing it down as everyone would typically do that, and I have here volatility, the market price of risk, but make it a power of the underlying, so that it becomes a CEV model. Here's a constant, and here's A minus 1, the exponent, okay? So this sits at this place. This way, this is now a CEV model in a risk-neutral, typical risk-neutral setting. So it's a very standard question. So just one step away from Black-Scholes, and I just start for communication with you, not from real world, I just start formally, just simply from risk-neutral thinking. I just say, okay, let's start from, assume this is a risk-neutral process, and let's see what's happening. Okay. And, of course, the Black-Scholes case would be included if I make A equal to 1, because then this whole thing becomes a constant. So we will exclude this, because this is a trivial case we know already very well. So, this means the hypothetical risk-neutral CEV dynamics is then of this form. I just plugged it now in here. And so the question is, what happens in general if A is not equal to 1? If A is, A is equal to 1, we have the Black-Scholes model, we know everything is fine. But if A is not equal to 1? If A is not equal to 1, I can do the following. I can rewrite my putative risk-neutral dynamics for this numerical portfolio in real-world terms. Why? Because the volatility of the numerical portfolio is the market price of risk. So that means I know how my change from, say, the risk-neutral Wiener process to the real-world Wiener process has to happen. So I plug it all in. Of course, the volatility part looks the same, but this is now a real-world Wiener process, and I get now this kind of drift addition herein, and this is now a real-world dynamics with having here a real-world Wiener process. And one has to discuss cases when A is less than 1 or plus than 1, so less than 1 or greater than 1, but let's just not go into this detail. What I observe when I take this STE, what I had just real-world dynamics, then I can observe by this transformation, I find X by E2 formula to satisfy such a stochastic differential equation. You see the square root of X here, constant in front, linear in X, constant here. So it is a square root process. It's something like, it's in the squared Bessel process family, and we know its dimension. It comes from a relation which sits here, and this in relationship gives me the so-called dimension, and we know a square root process of dimension greater than 2 is never hitting 0. A square root process of dimension less than 2, that's between 0 and 2, will, with strictly positive probability, hit 0. So that means there are events, the event hitting 0, which have a strictly positive probability for those dimensions less than 2, and for those with dimension greater than 2, this is a 0 probability event, hitting 0 by this process. Okay, so that's it. But what I can do is, I can check now what is my radon-nicotine derivative, or for the putative risk-neutral measure. Yes, that would be the benchmark savings account. I can calculate it, benchmark savings account here. This is more or less this kind of power of my Bessel process. This would be here the right power in this setting. Yes? Here, this, the first, it is not relevant for what we're looking at, but let's check it. It depends on A. When A is greater than, if A is greater than 1, we have here a mean reversion, otherwise not. But in any case, the square root process, but if the square root process is nothing else than a squared Bessel process of the same dimension times an exponential function, and now you can bring it anywhere. Look, I have now the freedom to choose your A such that it fits well, and we will see. And I will discuss it with you. But still, it's just that we are now in this situation. But what I can do is, I can look at the squared Bessel process, what we had, or the square root process, what we had before. But now, again, back under this putative risk-neutral process, just to see what's happening. And if you do it under the delta W hat theta, so the risk-neutral, putative risk-neutral Wiener process, then you find another term here at this place. And what it means, the dimension of the squared Bessel process or square root process has changed to this here, then you can read it off. So we have under real world and under putative risk-neutral world different dimensions. And the interesting thing is, this is a risk-neutral dimension, this is a real-world dimension, and it turns out, if A is less than 1, the dimension is greater than 2 for the real-world dynamics, which is fine, so the index is never hitting 0, and the risk-neutral is unfortunately less than 2. If A is greater than 1, another case, then the real-world is less than 2. It will hit 0, this index, which is not really a nice model. But the risk-neutral will never hit 0. That's just what's happening. It's just the nature of these two terms. This means this kind of graph here, if I put my A along this axis and A equal to 1 would be this, is the Black-Scholes case. If A is less than 1, say somewhere here, which is a reasonably realistic situation, for the real world dynamics, I find dimension something bigger than 2. Fine. But if I try to price it under this neutral, I would end up with a dimension less than 2. So you see these probability measures for the risk-neutral model, for the real-world model, are not equivalent. So there is, it's not an expression of what we know already. In principle, if there is a strict supermartingale coming up in your radon-nicotine derivative, then you have this problem. So here it is. But even in the other case, if you make now the power of the exponent greater than 1, what is happening, then the risk-neutral one will be never hitting 0, but the real-world one will hit 0. They are again not equivalent, so you can't do it. So, for this very simple model, you have already a problem. You cannot handle it anymore with risk-neutral thinking, in a way. You are, with a measure change, not in a feasible environment. So, we can look at the hypothetical risk-neutral measure. Let's just work it all out. Here sits the radon-nicotine derivative now. So you can really look at the total risk-neutral measure, more or less. So you integrate over the radon-nicotine derivative just with a one here, as over the entire set of events, and which will, of course, give you the expectation of the radonicotine derivative. So in this radonicotine derivative of the putative risk-neutral measure is, in this case, a strict supermartingale, if you have A less than 1, which is a case which we discussed at the beginning. And this means we have a similar situation as I showed you already for the minimal market model. We get the fact that the total probability, risk-neutral mass of this risk-neutral measure is at the very beginning adding up to 1, but later it loses mass. That's it. So we cannot go ahead with classical theory in that. So the measures are not equivalent, as I said, and the other case here for A greater than 1 we don't need to look at because there's explosion. So still, even that we cannot use risk-neutral pricing, we can now go ahead and just use also for this model some pricing, and we use them the real-world pricing, which I discussed. Yeah? And let's have a contingent claim. The fair price would be, according to the real-world pricing formula, just the expectation of the benchmark payoff times the numerator portfolio at the time where we are, to give us the price of this payoff at the time where we are. So you can use anything. We can now use this martingale representation, which I discussed. Here, everything is there. And we get clearly our description. And there is, in this complete market setting, of course, there's a no orthogonal term, but I know exactly what I need for hedging, and I can use it, and I can hedge. Okay, so this was the CEV model in that form, and you saw already things are not trivial if you go one step away. And this was not by accident, the A less than 1 case which we have. This is the one where you have the leverage effect, also the effect we want and we need to have. The volatility has, in principle, to explode up for an index when the index more or less crashes. We know that. Economically, it has to be there, and there's a thesis, PhD thesis, and some paper of Hardy Halley and myself, where we look for diffusion processes on at these boundary conditions. What is it? What happens? When is this local martingale, what we have in all cases, say for these benchmark securities here in a continuous market, when is this local martingale a true martingale, and when is this a strict local martingale? And there is an if and only if result, which tells you, it tells you more or less the boundaries describe, characterize fully what is going on there. And in particular, the boundary at zero has to have a certain nature to reflect, in principle, the index dynamics. And if there is something like, you know it from some literature, people talk about volatility explosion. And in other cases, it comes up in bubbles. It's all the same in principle. It is the fact when is this local martingale, the benchmark security, when is this a strict local martingale, which means a strict super martingale, or when it is still in a martingale. And there are many different cases possible. One is the radonicotine derivative, as we just discussed here, may become a strict super martingale. Then you have already a problem, then you cannot use risk-neutral pricing anymore. But you may have even a martingale for this, but you may have a security, which is when benchmarked a strict local martingale. This is then another thing which has then is named by some as some kind of a bubble. And then there are other cases too. Okay, let's go further with stochastic volatilities. Here are a number of models. And before we go there, I'd like just to point one other thing out, which comes from the benchmark approach, which has to do with statistics, with the empirical evidence. Because typically, we are used, econometricians also, to look at the prices as they come. So an exchange rate here, a stock price there. In some cases, one is looking also some regional indices also. But what it turns out is, if you make your object of statistical study a very well diversified portfolio, you get surprisingly accurate results of what you are doing. And this will be part of my talk in April when Yasin Etzahadia here has this other workshop where I talk about this. And so that's just a story which goes back many years. In the mid-90s, when Simon Hirst was my PhD student, he wanted to model stochastic vol, you know, which was very favorite at that moment. And I told him, look, Simon, you have here done stocks and you have here done exchange rate. I ask you the following. Take indices. Why indices? Indices are just the sums of things. It's more and more complicated. I said, no, take indices and tell me what is coming out. So he took the regional indices for what he could grab. And then he did all the studies, including the distribution, estimating the distribution of the local returns. And he came back and said, wow, I found that many of them are very close to student T. And then I said, let's make tests here, whatever tests we could do, including later also some likelihood ratio tests in the class of general hyperbolic distributions. And the 2T4 for this regional indices came very nicely out. And we had a paper on that. Later I had Ferguson, another student, and now with Renata Rendek even more. And these studies here use then the equivaluated index from these 104 indices. And here it's coming out very clearly with very high accuracy, student T4, and I show you some graphs later. So, and then some years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I gave talks about benchmark approach, and Harry Markowitz was just talking before me, and then we had a very nice discussion, and it was very fruitful. It gave me a lot also on the portfolio optimization side. He came to Australia, and we had also a very nice workshop. But in this, he showed me a paper he wrote in 96, or two papers with Usman, where he did the following. He took S&P 500 data and wanted also to see the local return distribution. He did not what I did, the likelihood ratio testing. He did a Bayesian approach and look in the Pearson family and found out the T distribution with, he said, 4.5 degrees of freedom roughly is what he feels is what's coming out. And if you now look today in the literature, T distribution is pretty much what the consensus starts to become in some way. Also, Breiman and Diaz did something for exchange rate with cupolas and so, and also the T4. And I have now a student who did it for cupolas very nicely, and the T4 is also coming out. So when we use this equivaluated index from the 104 industries, which you saw a while ago on my graphs there, and do the following, create a very large data set. By what? By first taking this equivaluated index for the 33 or 35 years of daily data we have in US dollar, and then transform this index, look at it in Canadian dollar, but shift it so that it has the same mean, the local returns, or just shift them all, and also scale them that they get the same variance on average as the US dollar one. So, and then superimpose them. And do that for all other currencies you could grab. So we had about at least 17, if not more, such currencies. So that means we had 33 years times 17 or so on data, daily data. So it's an enormous data set for local returns. And then empirically already you see in the histogram that this histogram here in this region where, of course, all the bulk of the observations are, is very close to what you see here in the red curve. The red is a student T4, then the T. Already with your naked eye, you can see the match is very good. And also in the tails, it does a job that you cannot... when I simulate such thing on a T4, I get very similar histograms for such data sets. Here is also the likelihood, the log likelihood function for that test what we did with this data. So what is it showing? In this generalized hyperbolic distribution setting, we had two parameters which describe the tails, yeah, the kind of shape of tails. And this is one, the alpha bar, and this is the other, lambda. So in this parameter set here, there are typical models which we know very well, also what kind of local returns they give us. So for instance, there's Ernst Eberlein has been talking for many years about the hyperbolic model. This is when you keep lambda constant, and let alpha bar run in this direction. So it's along this line here. So where the maximum is, there will be the right parameter set, or the right parameter choice. That is just locally like a maximization. The maximum will be later here. Okay, this is hyperbolic. Then Dilip-Madan has been the VG model, so the variance gamma model. So the variance gamma log returns are here. They are from here to here on this axis. Then alpha bar is zero, and there you should find them the maximum on this axis. Okay. Then there is a model by Olobandov-Nielsen. He has a normal inverse Gaussian model, which is the following. You have to take it to minus a half and go along this line. This will be then the Olobandov-Nielsen typical model. And then then in this setting, there is the student T distribution, local tone distribution, which is the one which sits on this axis. Here's Cauchy, although at the point minus 2, which is somewhere here, this is the student T distribution with 4 degrees of freedom. So you see here very nicely and very safely on the significance level that's very high, that the maximum is safely at this point here. So it's empirical evidence of diversified portfolio, well-diversified portfolio, where the local returns are. So anyone who wants to model local returns as an index should come up with local returns that have this kind of feature in one or the other form. How it's explained is another question, but that is just what we see. So when you estimate the model, this effect should come up. And otherwise you are far away. Okay, here are just showing you data on these things here. These are the different models, VG model, hyperbolic model. These are the test statistics. If they are 0.00002 somewhere here, then it's already on a 99% significance level. So they are even higher for all of them. In the Brazilian, I left them in, but we had only a couple of years data. I asked Renata Rendek, what is this here? And then she said, yeah, this is what's coming out, and said, tell me, why is it? And then she looked and said, oh, sorry, it was just, I don't know, 5 or 6 or whatever years of data. I said, leave it in, because nothing is perfect. Yeah, yeah, here you see the other. So that is also, you see very interestingly here, the degrees of freedom estimated. Yeah, these are the degrees of freedom. So 4.2, 4.7, here's a little bit, as it was in any case, the Brazil thing. But it's around 4, and if you average them up, in principle, they're very close to 4 altogether. Yeah? So that's what it says. So it's a very robust result and effect, which we have to acknowledge. So student D distributed with about 4 degrees of freedom is what stochastic volatility modeling should also deliver when you just do that. Otherwise, you are a bit far out. So what? How could you imagine, and I think this is also quite well understood in our community, when you like to generate such local returns and assume you have a stationary volatility process, how this effect comes, that you get a certain distribution, in principle you get mixing normals, the mixing normal distribution with some variance, and to get student T distribution, say with 4 degrees of freedom, what should be the distribution of the variance of your returns? It should be, the variance of the return should be distributed like the inverse of a gamma distribution with 4 degrees of freedom. It's just a fact. Then you get student T of 4 degrees of freedom. So the stationary distribution of our volatility process, our squared volatility process, should be inverse gamma, or the inverse of our squared volatility process should have a gamma distribution. Chi-square distribution or non-central chi-square distribution with 4 degrees of freedom. Then you get this result. So normal mixing, as here's just what I explained, the variance has to be that of an inverse gamma distribution. And now we can ask what kind of volatility models we have already may suit this. And then you can go through it. This is our discounted numerator portfolio again, and find volatilities. So take the Hull and White model. It will not have it, but here is just its dynamics. The Heston model, you know, the Scott model, Wiggins model, and the inverted gamma distribution we can write down. Okay, sure, we know that. That's not a problem. We can write down an STE for squared volatility of this form, which comes from a paper with Simon Hurst, David Hees, and myself. And in this family, I can be proved there, in this family, we now all these have inverse gamma distribution with some given degrees of freedom. Here they are. And so there are several cases. You can play, for instance, with this parameter psi, this power there. And cases are the 3 over 2 model. So that means the psi in that film becomes here the 3 for the theta square. Then you have more or less 3 over 2 theta square at this place. This is a model which in the early days when I complained about what Bankers Trust was telling me and looked at my own models and my own thinking that I came up and you find in the research reports of myself when I was still at the Australian National University, and this model I discussed there. And you find also the book by Lewis, and there's later other people who did that. And this is exactly the volatility process that comes under the minimum market model out. But I learned that one later. Then in other cases, when you set this psi what I had up there to, I think to 1 or so, then we get the arch diffusion limit, this kind of model where you have linear mean reversion and here multiplicative noise. Unfortunately, we don't have an exact distribution function, but we can exactly or almost exactly simulate it, by the way. So this model we have, this is also giving us the student T and the right choice of K and gamma student T4. So in this way, we can build up such two-factor models and check what is thus coming up and play with the implied volatility surfaces and find out what is going on. So and then the implied volatility surfaces with the right correlation do the right thing. If zero correlation, then we have, of course, the symmetric smiles, what we know. And if you get the correlation, for instance, negative, here's the correlation, then you have the negative skew, but if you make it positive, you can have the other skew. So, yes, in this way, there may be chances that these stochastic Weyl models with negative correlation do that. But these are things we know very well. We can study also the implied volatilities, depending on this curvature, depending on, say, wall of wall, roughly speaking. But these are things which are very well studied now in many papers. I have not to go too much over that. So let's just, these are typical prices, differences under different models. Interesting is the arch diffusion doesn't give us really so much freedom as we wanted for reasonable, historically maybe verifiable parameter changes, whereas the minimum market model, so that means the 3 over 2 model does. These are the observations which we made at that stage. Okay. I think probably from your, you'd like to have a 10-minute break, and then we go to the last part.
Three-page paper, and his motivation was to write a whole.
So let's continue. There was a nice question in the break, which I just like to pick up. There was a question, and what about the change of numeraire technique, which we use a lot? So Helgiman, Nicolas Carouy, Rocher, and Jamshidian, and it's something we know very well. So in my book, you find something to it. It's very easy. In principle, you have the real-world pricing formula, in any case, start from it. Then you can rewrite in the way as I did with the savings account, with any strictly positive numeraire, you can rewrite by multiplying and subtracting, and what you will end up at the then, in principle, you get something like this. There's something which is then the radonicotine derivative for your typical measure change, of course, discounted by whatever then your numeraire will be. And now it's depending if this is a martingale, then the change of numeraire technique gives you exactly the same prices as we got on the real-world pricing already. If it is not a martingale, then what I explained to you with the savings accounting, you can divide by the expectation of the radonicotine derivative, but if it is a strict super martingale, this thing will have been less than one, and you get by this an inequality sign. So with any other numeraire formally applied, you will find that you find a pricing rule which gives you something greater or equal than this minimal price, which we know already that it is a minimal price. Yeah? And if it is a martingale, then it is here 1, and you can do this numeraire change, and the base rule gives you, in principle, then your pricing formula under whatever numeraire. Very interesting is the case of the numeraire chosen as a fair zero coupon bond, which is a forward measure, the T forward measure. It's very nice if you make sure that your fair zero coupon bond, also your zero coupon bond you choose as numeraire, is the fair zero coupon bond in your investment universe, no problem. You can do this numeraire change. So with the T forward measure, I have no problem because I know the fair zero coupon is a martingale. Now the benchmark fair zero coupon is a martingale. And I have then the radonicotine derivative in any case being a martingale, so I can do this numeraire change. So I have no problem with T forward measures. Very nice under the benchmark approach. However, I have a problem if there's a deterministic interest rate and someone says, my zero coupon bond is just a savings bond, and then still has the dynamics for the index to model empirically or to fit in over a long time, and where the super martingale, strict super martingale property of this benchmark savings account kicks in. Then there is a problem. Yeah, so, but the true fair zero coupon bond, or very good modeling of it, makes it very nice and convenient. Yeah? So the change of numeraire technique can be nicely applied, of course, also in a benchmark approach, but make sure that your benchmark numeraire is a martingale. Then everything is fine. Okay, that's just a comment on the question that came up in the back. So, okay, let's go for the minimal market model, because I had discussed already several times in some way. I'd like just to repeat a few things and build something up before at the end we might go to the markets with event risk, like credit and other modeling allowing that. So the discounted numeraire portfolio, the discounted gross optimal portfolio, has this kind of stochastic differential equation in our continuous market. This is here the absolute market price of risk. I may have had these many Wiener processes. They aggregate now into this Wiener process, which I could show by the Levy theorem that it is truly a Wiener process, and now we have it here. So remember, that was my argument at the very beginning when we had this motivation. There is a discounted S&P. We may interpret it as a proxy for the numeraire portfolio, and we see already for the S&P that it is really growing, even when discounted. If you look at the log, it's really growing with some rates about 5% that we can estimate here. These Great Depression thing is what we just experienced. Now we are back a little bit, but that is all fine. So what we know, the logarithm of the discounted numeraire portfolio is not a transformed Wiener process. If this is the look of the SNP, it's not something which goes out here in this, with this variance which the geometric point in motion would give us. It's not. It's a mean reverting thing around some kind of a fundamental value. The longer we go, the more it looks in a log scale that we are close to something. Of course, if you look absolutely at it, it's of course still a big big range, as we saw in our recent market correction. Yes, 50%, 60% market correction, this is all possible, but that does not mean that you have to go in log scale anywhere here or here. This is a completely other magnitude. We are not there, and I will not go there. So, this is not a Wiener process, and it's also not a process of independent increment, like Levy processes. It's too simple. We know that there is, but we know there's a feedback effect. And this feedback effect actually needs to be there, otherwise we have no chance to have some kind of a reversion back to that, what I would call your fundamental value, this long-term growth of the index which we see. Yeah, and so here is a link to other statements in the literature where one is thinking in terms of a very simplistic model, and there's a danger to stick further with the thinking of the Samuelson, Black, Scholz, Merton type geometric point in motion model. It is nice for a lot of calculations, but it was leading our community a lot into a situation where we think that this kind of model is pretty close to reality. No, even simple generalizations of it are not close to reality when we go long term. So, the discounted numerator portfolio drift is in any case there, and I was saying this is an economic variable, and I showed you when we had our discussion, I make this my parameter process. When I do it, volatility comes out as this over this, and this is just because the drift and the diffusion coefficient in the numerator portfolio, so in this optimum more or less for portfolio optimization, this is very important. Also, let's come back. Numerator portfolio is a result of an optimization, so you think of log optimality. The result of this is that the drift and the diffusion coefficient are now linked. If you give me any security, their drift and diffusion coefficient are relatively free. But as a result of diversification, or which is equivalent to log optimization, as what I have shown with the diversification theorem, as a result of it, you get a link between drift and diffusion coefficient. And if the drift coefficient has economic meaning and is supported by economic activity, which it is, then the diffusion coefficient will have to reflect that too. So it means its volatility, or however you model, then the diffusion part has to have a link to it. Here I do it. I make the drift, that's my parameter, it can be anything so far. Then the volatility, if I look at the spaceholder volatility, it has a very specific structure, it's this. And then you can go further and argue, yeah, if it is so that this is volatility, then maybe I want to have it as a stationary process and find me stationary processes, maybe with the stationary distribution which gives me student T when I have local terms and stuff like that. Good. So there's leverage effect in principle naturally in here. If this is a process of which is slowly varying in some form and this fast varying, then you see already there is a leverage. Because if the index goes up, volatility goes down. If the index goes down, volatility goes up. It's just naturally in. And still I have not modeled it. I need just to have it slowly moving in whatever form. And of course it should grow as this grows, otherwise it will be not something stationary in some form. So this is very natural. The economy underlying it is doing it. And I don't need any utility for it. I don't need any demand-supply equilibrium relationship. It's not necessary. This comes afterwards. And I can check it out, and it's not clear, and I believe, sorry to say that, so this is not the primary thing, the demand supply and all this. such simple statistical laws as law of large numbers give us already what we see, most of it. Naja, also you, also I interpret the unit root as a stationary a statement about stationarity, right? Well, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about the index, the diversified portfolio, and so on. Yes, yes, yes. Clear. It is also so. Look, a company, almost any company, has an IPO, it starts, and it's successful, it's growing, and 90% die immediately, and then it's growing and maybe becomes really successful, becomes big, becomes a big institution, and then it gets problem with itself because of its history and its constraints and whatever tradition, and finally, either technology is no longer important or for internal reasons it dies in principle and is overtaken by others. But the industry itself, transport, or other things we know, yeah, food or so, it will survive as long as human beings will be on this earth in some way. Yeah? And new technologies will come and make it more productive, yes, and so on. Yeah? But a simple company, it is just coming and going, forget it. And it can do anything. Yeah? An industry is already a more stable object, but this is, I think, the real mean reverting thing, what we see. But okay, so in any case, we have then this SDE, and as I said, now I can go and try to understand this. Of course, the experience I mentioned it already, this tells us this is in any case a time transformed squared Bessel process of dimension 4. The transform time, make it so, a quarter of integral over the drift. Also, the integrate just the entire drift and think of this as being a martingale term, which under my model, for instance, you can show. And this would be a nice time scale. That means accumulated underlying value, a quarter of it is pretty much your time scale, which is a very natural, nice thing. And with this time scale, the same process, and also scale your Wiener process in this time, so you get the square root of alpha in this part, you get from the earlier equation just 4 times d phi plus twice square root of x. So there's no parameter in it anymore. It's just a time transformed squared Bessel process of dimension 4 in phi time. And phi is just accumulated underlying wealth. That's it. And this is where the economy is just going. It's very natural. So the scaling is in this accumulation of wealth. So, and this is economically founded and just there. It's a fact. I have not even specified this time. If it is slowly varying, then it is already in this slowly varying time principle, the squared Bessel process of dimension 4. And I can go further. I can say, take the square root of that thing. E2 formula gives me some term here, and it gives me a half square root alpha dw. So that means if I look at the quadratic variation of the square root of my index, then I see this time, this is just a quarter of that. So the quadratic variation of the square root of my process gives me insight what should be this accumulated wealth in some way, if the world would behave like a diffusion model. Okay, that is another thing, but under this assumption. So that means I can see this. I can see this time. And since I said diversified portfolios are good proxies for the numerator portfolio, we can try to see this observable thing. And this is here for the data which I showed you always from 1920 until now, this kind of quadratic variation of the square root of our S&P, discounted S&P. So, of course, there's something going on from time to time, but this general picture is quite nice. So now I can go back and say, okay, I had this idea when I formed the minimum market model, just let alpha be an exponential function, this one constant, and fit it just in here. We can do that. So if alpha is this with exponential function, then I can just try to fit these both parameters. The eta will come from this slope here, and the alpha comes from where it sits. So that's all what I need. Yes? Yeah, as you will see, the function which is doing it has some exponential structure, and then of course any small change at the end becomes quite extreme in a way. And this is, I don't know, this is this has already to do with the market crash type thing, yes? Of course, here's a mixture of things. The minimum market model itself is for the very long term quite robust and fine. But, of course, you need another factor to describe, and we will do that later here, to describe, in principle, the short-term market activity, if you want, and this is then the things go a bit faster, which also has an effect like here, yeah? Look, there's 87 crash here and things like that, yeah? But that's fine. So, although we get the stylus minimum market model by just making this assumption. And then, in this case, the phi function is of this form. And you see the exponential here coming up. And then you see, of course, if it's not perfect, a constant, if it is an integral, eta SDS, and eta is sometimes larger as in other places, then, of course, you see that quite clearly. So, here I just fit now into the same curve. With some eta, which is the estimated eta, which is more or less also what comes from here, fitted in. And you see, from the long term, it's reasonable. Of course, we know to get all these other things, we would need an extra factor, and of course, we go for that later. So then, interesting, what I mentioned already is not looking, and we saw then we had already the volatility considered. Interesting is the ratio of the discounted index over this exponential function. So normalizing it so that it becomes a stationary process. And then we remember, you remember, I had then this square root process already out, where this net growth rate is just here. And also I point just out then, that means the discounted index is just a square root process times this exponential. Or if you want it in your currency itself, then you have to multiply this what is here still with the savings account. So it's all easily modeled. The important thing is model the square root process, multiply it with this net growth and exponential, and multiply it with the savings account, and you get your numerator portfolio. Very easy. You can simulate and everything. You know the transition density, everything perfect. And this was already the kind of calibration which I gave you. In principle, here is the normalized numerator portfolio, how such a picture looks like. So look, this was in the 30s, this crash, and this was 2000, our top, and then we had now here these things, and at the moment we are somewhere back. So the normalized. But the interesting thing is the normalized numerator portfolio is the inverse of the square of the volatility in the minimal market model. Okay, we'll come later. But here is an this kind of graph logarithm of this index becomes what? Becomes a logarithm of the square root process, which is showing you these fluctuations here. Yeah. Plus initial value plus just this straight line where the slope is the net growth rate. So a very easy, very robust argument. So, and the volatility is 1 over the square root of this normalized index of the stationary process. Yes, when the index is going up, then volatility is going down and vice versa. We see that here. And the squared volatility process satisfies here this 3 over 2 model, which I mentioned already. But you see the negative sign here. This is these negative correlations, the leverage effect type thing. And here's volatility, if you just take it from the stylus minimum market model in the blunt form as you have it. So that's going on. So the transition density, we know, important is that you have special functions, a modified Bessel function of the first kind comes in at this form, but otherwise it's all very nicely known, and in principle it has to do with a non-central chi-square distribution, which is very well implemented, understood. And yeah, here it is with some parameters. Sensitivities, you can work with it, you can do pretty much all with it. By the way, I'm doing it now multi-dimensional with my people, and it's working very nicely. So zero coupon bonds, we discussed in principle earlier, it's just the real-world pricing formula, $1 benchmark, and what comes up is the savings bonds, with here assumed deterministic interest rate, and then what is it? Expectation of discounted numerator portfolio at the beginning over discounted numerator portfolio here. So it's pretty much the inverse of the discounted numerator portfolio, which is just the benchmark savings account. So it's a radon-nicotine derivative, which sits here. So here this expectation is the one of the radon-nicotine derivative. And if it is a strict super martingale, the expectation is not one. If it were just a standard model in the risk-neutral world, this benchmark savings account normalized to one at the beginning would be just always one. And there's no effect. But now we have strict super martingales in here in that case, and this is less than one as soon as the time difference starts to emerge. And this is where all this comes from. So the fair zero coupon bond is then having this kind of expression. I pointed this out. Here is this explicit term, which we fortunately find, and you see the relationship. Here is a savings bond greater than this fair zero coupon bond. You can read it off, because this is here a positive thing. Right? Yeah, for simplicity. But you could do it with stochastic interest rate, and then Jensen's inequality will make even certain things even more. Yeah. So, yes, as this heavy went over these kind of graphs. Well, the last thing here is where I show you now in real terms the savings bond of my grand-grandmother. It was a fair zero coupon bond of my grand-grandfather. And this is the same amount if my grand-grandmother would have got the same money as my grand-grandfather would have invested it in her savings account type thing, and she would end up is 2.3% of what the other strategy would give. And yesterday we discussed in my room a bit of a question. Who was it? Is he here? Not. But there was a discussion in my room where we discussed what is happening. Moment. No, I think it doesn't fit now. Here, let's just go on. It's not necessary. So, you have on the other part of yesterday and also today and tomorrow something on interest return structure modeling. So, this fits, of course, also here. We can look at it. And interesting is what happens there. Can we say something? Yes, we can. Look at the forward rate. This instantaneous continuous compounding forward rate, so it's minus the partial derivative of the log of the fair zero coupon bonds. And for deterministic interest rate, it will just end up as a short rate, the deterministic short rate, plus some term. And this term wouldn't be there in risk neutral, but here now there will be a term. And this term is important. Now the term comes, of course, from this was a product, as you saw before, and the log of it gives me then two terms, and the first term gets you for deterministic interest rate what the forward rate should be. It's a short rate at that future time, and it was deterministic, but plus some other term. So I call it market price of risk contribution, because this is a short rate contribution, and then there is something coming from the strict super martingale. I call it market price of risk contribution. And the market price of risk contribution can be calculated in our case, because the minimum market model gives me that. It's, of course, nothing else than the effect from this strict super martingale situation. And I can calculate it, and here it is. Okay, it looks a bit complex, but it's there. And interesting is to look what happens under the minimum market model if I go with my time to maturity, my tenor, to infinity, far out. What happens then with this market price of risk contribution? Interestingly, it converges to the net growth rate itself. So what is the growth, what is the slope of this thing? And this makes economic sense. What does it say? If I give to a bank some funds, also in a long-term deposit, like a zero coupon bond, they, when they have for a very long time, they can take this money, invest it in the equity markets, in the numerator portfolio, and have this growth above the interest rate. And if they are in competition with other banks, and they have really 80-100 years time, they should give this in principle back to me also as a zero bond, because in any case, on average, they make this money. What they get is in principle the total growth, which is the short rate plus the net growth rate. And why they should keep all this net growth from the equities themselves in a competitive market, they will just take as much as they need to get the business. So risk neutral would just not do that. Risk neutral will give you long rates that never fall, and they have a theorem with Costas Kardaras on that, also just on from this result. But here it is so then we get this extra effect, and this is again a consequence of this real world modeling and having fair zero coupon bonds in that situation where we have strict super martingales for savings accounts. So very important effect, and on top of what comes from the short rates, in the interest return section you get something extra, and it can be significant, because the net growth rate in the U.S. market is 5%, interest rate at the moment is 0.25% or less, and in the long term it matters, although it's of a similar magnitude, interest rate and the net growth rate of the economy. And it means in the long term, if you model this interest return structure, the forward rate curves, without looking at what I am doing here, you make a mistake. You make a mistake. Also, as long as we have, say, independent interest rates from the discounted index from the market price of risk, then just you get whatever you would have got in the term structure modeling that we have at this place. Let me call it then short rate contribution, as I do it. Right. So you just work that out, plus something which is non-negative, and this is important, and this is asymptotically, if you model the market right, it will be the net growth. And this is something substantial. And if you go out for 30 years with a zero bond, or when these things are there, then the risk-neutral price is not right. Also the risk-neutral rate is not right. So the pricing is just not correct. This is, has consequences for term structure modeling. So we have some papers out on it. It's some also more recent papers. One is just coming out in quantitative finance in the next issue. So that's these are effects. Here are graphs. This is just the market price of risk contribution to give you an idea. It has a similar effect as what you saw here. At the beginning, not much effect, and later it does something. So this is the time to maturity, and here is the growth rate. So take a growth rate of 5%. So very flat at the beginning, no market price of risk contribution for the first 1, 2, 3 years. Then it's building up, and asymptotically it runs exactly into the ETA, into the net growth rate, okay? So this is a fact. It's a fact, it's also logic when you think economic terms. If I really give my money to that bank, I like to get also something from the equity premium if I leave it with them for a very long time. So, okay, a bit of free snacks from savings bond. This was a situation where we had, under the minimum market model, one thing. We had the fair zero coupon bond we could invest and borrow that money from a savings account. That means we have then to pay this interest and all these things back. So, and then this portfolio, what we have, starts at zero, and it would be a strong arbitrage if it always remained non-negative and would give us something strictly positive with strictly positive probability later. It is not a strong arbitrage, but it is something like a free snack or free lunch is vanishing risk in whatever form. We start at zero, and at the end, we will have 1 minus P0T of this thing, and this is clearly greater than zero. Yes, at the end, we have it. But on the way, there is, in principle, then, due to the fluctuations here, some chance and some very great likelihood that it will get negative. So Matthäus couldn't run his entire fund on this thing, because then the bankruptcy laws will kick in. Still, and this is interesting, still, this portfolio has even a lower bound. Huh. Yeah? So. No, it has a lower bound. So this is really something which we allow in our market to have, but we don't call it an arbitrage. Let them have it. Yeah? But you have to bet it into a wealth process, in a total wealth process, where you can afford that. But you cannot run an entire fund just on that. That's your own business. You are bankrupt then with almost certainty. Yeah, sure. Yeah. You get that? Sure. We can do that. So then we go back to this incomplete market situation which I had. Then we have to model what you have as this orthogonal term. And yes, we can maybe check that out. And if it is just a hedge error because of discrete trading, or yes, we can. Okay, also just then you can find that out in some way. Of course, under assumptions again, yes. Although I can tell you about errors, I showed you the profit and loss, the benchmark profit and loss for the zero coupon bond. We have similar results, and that's a paper with Hardy Halley and myself you find on the webpage, where we talk about hedging options in the long run or so, and these are digitals and puts and calls and so on. And there you find these kind of distributional things and on the real data. So, yeah. So in any case, also this gives a little bit of a hint and the link. Is this something you cannot do on the under standard classical theory, but we have no problem with it, and you can quantify and can ask any question in this environment. So, for instance, that's what you ask. So, and Rivenstein and Willard have in their paper things like that, and they call it cheap thrills. Yeah, I underline again what is here different. This minimum market model is a class of models which I think will reflect realistically or more realistically the market than what we do today. They have now equivalent risk neutral measure. And yes, I have no problems in having free lunches with managing risk. But there's no strong arbitrage. Why? Super martingale property, I don't need to care about it. But it means also hedging or pricing on the basis of an arbitrage argument is not enough. If I can hedge, self-financing, and everything looks fine, this price could come from a strict super martingale, should be higher than some competitor. And I still can't price and hedge everything. I take the rewrite pricing formula, it gives me the minimal price, and I take the Kunitra Watanabe, Kunitra Watanabe decomposition, it tells me the hedge. So, yeah, super multiple policies, let's not go too far. This is things which we discussed already. And we could go for European call option. Here is a European call. We have, since we have the explicit density for the square root process here and square Bessel process, this is a call benchmarked, and here in domestic currency, explicit formula. Look, this formula looks very similar to what you know from Black-Scholes. It is the underlying times some kind of a distribution function thing. It's a chi-square distribution here with 4 degrees of freedom, 1 minus it, minus strike discounted times a distribution function. Again, a non-central chi-square distribution function, but with other parameters here, it's the degrees of freedom 0. But these are distribution functions. So it's like the ND1 and ND2 as you have in Black-Scholes. It's just the same story. The complexity is exactly the same. Although you are not getting more complex here when we do benchmark approach on this for these kind of questions. And these are the non-centrality things. There are papers with Hari and Sven Müller. And implied volatility surface for the stylized minimum market model, for the stylized minimum market model. It gives you, you remember I showed you this from Ramakanth and De Fonseca, this kind of typical implied volatility surface for an index. It gives you also the negative skew. It gives you some term structure at the money, very similar. It gives you for far out, although long dated, you get to pretty much a flat, also a straight negative skewed curve, but it's also pretty straight at the beginning. Okay? So the question is, we are not this close to reality, but still we are on the way on it, and this is with one parameter more or less. I get it with the eta, and then I have it all on this level here. No, but I like to get a model. I like to get a model which is in principle reflecting on average with a stylized version of it what we see. So on average we are here okay, we are here reasonably okay, but we are not really good at the beginning. And this is clear why. We saw already this time which I showed you. This time is still a process in some form, which is not the straight exponential curve. It's having some uncertainty in it. And this uncertainty is it. I can show whatever model I take. If I make the time random in a minimal market model, I get the following effect always. Here it stays almost like that, and the negative skew stays, but here this gets curved. So this is exactly what we see. It's very robust, whatever things you have. But important is now, when you calculate implied volatility, and this is important for the market now today here, you should not take simply the short rate, even if you assume maybe you have a deterministic interest rate model. This is wrong. The implied volatility surface will be not the right one which you have to look at. You have to take your fair zero coupon bonds, and look, and this in this way, this kind of, let's call it yield or so, that you calculate out of the fair zero coupon bond and plug this into your Black-Scholes formula. It's a place where the short rate sits, and then calculate the implied volatility. And then the implied volatility for puts and calls will be the same, and it makes sense. If you don't do this, you get for puts and calls different implied volatilities, for instance. And this is likely happening now when people just go for longer dated maturities in this way. So we have European puts and calls. Of course, you can also calculate it. That means also the put-call parity holds only if, even in a model with deterministic interest rate, if you have the fair zero coupon bond here. If you take just the savings bond in this place, then it's wrong. It doesn't work out. So you have to have fair zero bond, and you can of course calculate the put price. And as I said, in here's a paper where we have very good hedge performance, calls, puts, barriers, digitals. Yes, and here's probably we converge towards finale in some way. Let's look let's look in this environment for the hypothetical risk-neutral price. Okay, let's say there is a group of traders that does it as they learned it, and they have a master's and they do that, or PhD, and they just do it. So what they are doing is they form it, a European call for the numerator portfolio in that way as they learned it. So they apply risk-neutral type pricing, also something which is more or less on the right-hand side, and see what is happening. Let's just do that. Okay, so the benchmark hypothetical risk-neutral call price process, if you do it, and if you plug it all in, and I can do it here, what will happen is it will be still a local martingale, this benchmark price. It will be still a local martingale. Good. Furthermore, I know that the payoff of a call, let me just go back one or two slides, of a call on the index is the following. It's S delta star minus K, positive part of it, divided by S delta star. You see that inside this is bounded. This benchmark payoff is bounded. Look, bring this in, it's 1 minus this over S delta star, positive part is bounded. So, but this is nice. Then, this local martingale, what I have, a bounded local martingale, we know very well, a bounded local martingale is, in any case, a martingale. So the benchmark call price, even if I do it by formal risk-neutral pricing, yeah, I will, if I do everything else right, then I will get a correct price. There will be equality, because this price will be then the true martingale and the fair price. So there will be no problem. I have all these prices the same, if assuming I get all the other things right in my risk-neutral formalization. Now let's look at the put-call parity. So let's take at the risk-neutral type put-call parity. So then you take the put, this risk-neutral put, you will get from the risk-neutral, which is equal to real-world priced put, minus this plus strike times, and now I have savings bond. So I do, of course, what the risk-neutral person has to do. It will be a savings bond, and I indicated already this gives us, of course, a difference. And, of course, since here is the savings bond and not the fair zero coupon bond, I clearly see my inequality. That means my fair put will be less than my here so obtained risk-neutral put, just because the bonds were already in this direction. So I know that. Here will be, and it will be strictly less because my savings bond is strictly greater than the fair zero coupon bond. So, okay, what else we can say? There will be differences then in asymptotic put prices. Let's look at asymptotic fair zero coupon bond price. Okay, what is really critical? Critical is what happens when we have the underlying here, say the discounted numerator portfolio going to zero. So this market crash situation. This is when everything here, this is a kind of boundary where things are different. So for a fair zero coupon bond, you can look at the formula, you find out if you make your underlying to zero, the fair bond price will also converge to zero, which is fine and common sense. Asymptotic fair European call, look at the formulas and go through it, and what you will find also here, the fair European call, if the index of the market crashes, the fair call have no value anymore. So asymptotic fair put call parity, I can just go through, you can immediately see that also the fair put, when the index crashes, will have no value. So in a crash situation, market crisis, the puts have not much value under real world pricing. However, look for the risk-neutral puts. The risk-neutral puts comes from all these formulas here, and you see here's a fair put. Asymptotically, this will go to zero, and this other term here, if t goes to infinity, this is fine. Here, this goes to some large value, so this will be exponential of 0, so this will be 1, so this will be more or less the kind of limit thing what we have to work with. So it will go towards strike times here savings bond ratio in that form. And this is greater than 0. So what happens if you price under the classical theory puts on indices long dated puts, like a pension fund put or so? The reverse pricing tells you this is having no value. Yeah? You should not pay or not charge much for it. However, if you do it under the risk neutral one, there is value and it will come up. So here's the point. I don't know, some of you may know there's a book by Janet Tavakoli. She must be known more here in this environment, I think. It's an interview with Warren Buffett or so. And if you start to read it after chapter 2 or whatever, it comes up. There is, and the topic of this question is, Warren, what would you do, what would you think about, what do you think in principle about Wall Street pricing and hedging and so on? And then there's some kind of a comment, yes, some entity took over in Toronto, I think, and he threw out the derivative people because he felt he didn't agree with it. And then he goes on, a put on an index, long dated, at the money put. These guys charge wrong prices. It's totally overpriced. I know that the index will grow over some time, somehow like that. I want an at the money put. Okay? Risk neutral pricing will treat it like Black-Scholes type stuff. It will give me really a substantial price for that put, even if there's a long time horizon. This year. Okay? But it's, I know, I'm Warren Buffett, I know that the money is here. This will be here. Why should I pay much? The payoff is almost zero value there. No, it shouldn't be much. It should be something much smaller. And you find this there, and he said, look, I never purchase a put in that market, but I'm happy to sell these. And I have been doing it quite regularly. Okay? So maybe this is the finale of that whole presentation. You have far more on this slide. And in the afternoon, there is later another where I talk about guaranteed annuity. I'm sorry I didn't come to the case with event risk, but it's all fully generalized. You can do it with jumps and nice effects extra come in. We have still explicit formulas. Yes, and there's of course far more. Although I can tell you that I hope to present at Bachelier's and really, and also maybe when I come again in April here, the results in my group, which we do, we have a nice separate supercomputer cluster type thing. So I have 60,000 stocks, the entire market, all the data from 73 until now daily. We have the most diversified index on our machines, and I have it also now intraday, 1 second by second. Also, we form that index, and I can tell you it's behaving much better than the 104S, which I showed you, the EWI 104S. And yeah, you can use it, you can touch it, and it will come in the real world also commercially in some form. So it will change things in some way, not only mathematically. There's a lot that can be gained. No, we have time, of course, but I didn't want to go on and later. No. Yeah. Sure.
So the hypothetical options that at best they are approximating the options of the industry.
Yes. Yes. No, no. Also, look, it's just we could go on. We could have a part three of all of it. Currencies, exchange rates are already like stocks. As an exchange rate is like a stock, you have in principle the denomination of the numerator portfolio in one currency and this denomination in another currency, and the ratio of it gives you a stock price. And the other currency could be IBM shares, so I have an IBM stock. Okay, so that's, and here's these slides are in principle then there, and you can just do it all and start maybe with a stylus minimum market model for each of these denominations. Of course, then you get a two-factor situation when you have an exchange rate or a stock price or an exchange price to handle, and then you have to look at the consequences. And when you have two currencies and look at the resulting implied volatility smile, we get an almost symmetric, but not perfectly symmetric, implied volatility smile. Also, what you would suggest is a graph. No, I don't know. I don't force it now. Maybe not. It's not in this here, but in the book, and so find it. Then you get the smile. And when you go for a commodity, which is another situation, there we know that in quite certain cases that you have not a negative, you have a positive smile. We can easily explain it there because of the nature of the volatility of the futures of the commodities and of the others, how they are linked. So these kind of things are there and very naturally come out. Of course, there's a bit more to invest. I'm not handling an exchange rate as one geometric Brownian motion or so with one stochastic volatility. For me, it is clear there are two economies. I look at each each currency against the rest of the world, which is my index, numerator portfolio. Then I model it here, I model it there. I get maybe all the index options in this market and this market and all these things right, have a calibrate and so on. And then I put it together and find out what this does. And if I know the dependent structure between these both say squared Bessel processes in for one and the other market, they're of course related in some way, then I get in principle the consequence of it, just numerics and mathematics. And fortunately, I can tell you wherever I put my finger, wherever we looked, it was all very, very reasonable. Also including the commodities with the other smile and things like that. Everything. Now everything is like here. Yes, a stock is a constituent, but a savings account can be also a constituent. What I look all these what I call primary security accounts, so these are in principle the constituents, and I look at it. So here is a JACE. So this is in domestic currency, but I just take my numerator portfolio and express it in this unit. And this object here, is it now what I look at, and I look for all J's at these. And these are the most undisturbed descriptions of what this J stock is doing, because it's the movement of the J stock against the rest of the world. It's like in a planetary system, you look at everything against the sun, yeah? And then you can disentangle it. You get a reasonable model. If you wouldn't do it, you just back in the kind of descriptive astronomy where people say, and for a while we could see. But once I understood the whole system, how it works, they could say when the comet comes back. And this is how we do it here. Yeah? Yes? Yes. Yeah, so I can tell you this is a lot of discussions, and in a couple of days' time I will discuss this a lot again with in Munich, when I'm in Munich, with Munich Re people. These are facts, and things, what is wrong is certain companies got put on their portfolio, which are wrongly priced in one form, if they have problems now. If you're on the right side, then there's not a problem. And the question here, which, for instance, in with the team what I am working with Munich Re, what we are looking is we need to go finer into the structure. And I was expecting this kind of question. I have now an index in my market which is not in the Muret portfolio exactly, and then I have to work on it and have to see what is going on there between the Muret portfolio and this. And this is then a delicate question. And then we have to have here this regional index and this. And this has to be carefully modeled. And then there, interesting things can happen. They are both diversified, but they are related. One is having a larger volatility and another volatility. And what I have seen there so far on the data and on the calibration and the kind of modeling is reasonably challenging. It's not just simply that I handle this all with a minimum market model. No, we come back to engineering type thing, what we see here all the day when we do have a stochastic volatility workshop or so. Yeah. So a Bergoni model, and that it goes even then you come to VIX and variance swaps and all these kind of things, and this has to be then sorted out. Yeah, and there these puts then their effects are, but in principle these puts on the index, the prices for low levels, they have been simply too high. And when some companies have a problem, maybe they are short a put, I don't know. Yes, that's really the kind of thing. Maybe there's a little bit more, but in principle, it's just them pointing out what we have discussed all the time and bringing it to a more industry audience, as you both have asked me to do. So I try that then in the afternoon, which will repeat some of it, but there may be also a bit of different things.